All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming in. Welcome to Succeeding at Safety. We did it, and you can too. My name is Matt Linsky. I am the lead microbiologist and manager for Brewing and Distilling Analytical Services, which is a mouthful, so you can just call us BDAS. I'm also on the BA's quality group, and I'm really excited to introduce this team who is also as excited to talk about safety for you guys today. Before we introduce our wonderful speakers, just a couple housekeeping items. You will see there should be, once we get into this, a QR code, or you can use a hashtag. We're using Slido once again for questions, and there might be some polls that these folks have. No polls? Okay, just questions this time. And also at the end, if you guys can give us some feedback on what you thought about the presentation today, that would be excellent. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our team. We've got standing up here also another Matt. Matt Stinchfield is the safety ambassador for the Brewers Association. Next to me, Jimmy Vollm, brewmaster for Thompson Island Brewing. Next to him, we've got Brian Confer, head brewer and co-owner at Stormcloud Brewing. In the middle there, Abby Ferry, senior risk control consultant at Gallagher. Rachel Bell is the safety specialist for Canarchy. And finally, that's not Tom Cruise on the end, that's Jeff Mason, plant manager and HR manager at Ska Brewing Company. All right, if you'll all give them a warm round of applause. All right, take it away.
Thank you, Matt. Next time there are stairs there for your safety. I'm sorry, it was just too easy. I've been waiting all week for somebody to do that. Well, listen, okay, so you're probably all pros at this by now, but if this is your first time for Slido, snap that or go to slido.do or slido.com, and the hashtag is CBC22, and then find today, pull down Ballroom B, and we won't have any polls for you today. We've got lots of fun stories instead, and we will take questions throughout the whole thing. Queue up your questions. We've given a good amount of time for questions we think you'll have at the end, and you can upvote questions that you read so you don't have to have the same question in there twice, and we'll take them from the top down at the end. And I think I said pretty much all that just now. Let's see. Okay. So, as Matt said, I'm Matt Stinchfield, Safety Ambassador for the Brewers Association. I'm also original chair of the Safety Subcommittee, which we started way back in 2013. We're almost coming up to our 10th anniversary. It was the first technical subcommittee started under the technical committee, and we have done a lot of good things. We've created a lot of written resources. We answer your questions on the forum. We field speakers for CBC and for webinars throughout the year. And then I travel around the country and speak to state guilds and convey safety messages at state guild meetings. So we're really trying every means we can to let you know about the resources that we have available. The plug I want to give you right now is if you go to brewersassociation.org, and then you'll see a little multicolored wheel. That's the resource hub. Click that. That will take you to a page that contains, at last count, probably close to 800 resources on every subject having to do with running a brewery. And the safety resources that are clearly indicated there don't have any paywall or membership requirement to access. MBAA agrees with us on this policy, and both institutions make all of our safety resources free for anybody around the planet, because why would we keep safety from anybody? So we alone in that safety header have over 100 resources available for you. Past CBCs going back for quite a few years, webinars and other resources, white papers, one-pagers, and more elaborate best management practices documents. So with that, let me say a little bit more about each of our speakers. It was really a great task and a joy of mine to hunt down these folks and find people who represented all different sides of brewery operations who have had gone through an evolutionary process, let's say, of improving their safety programs. And it's probably self-evident, but there is no finished safety program. There's no, we're done, it's perfect. We have no worries, we have no injuries, nothing ever breaks, nothing goes wrong. That really, if you're motivated by the idea of trying to get to that safety nirvana, that's okay. I'm not going to dissuade you from doing that. But in actual fact, you know, we're probably a long, long ways away from there. So what these folks are going to do is tell you about where they've come from in terms of safety experiences, and you might be able to relate closely with that. And then some things that they've done to institute better safety programs at their breweries. And then, you know, we're going to finish with a cautionary tale or two. So let me tell you about, from closest to me, from my left, Jimmy Valm. Although Jimmy, Harriet Watt University graduate from Scotland, worked at Heineken Manchester, Brooklyn Brewery, and then Cape May, and who would I leave out?
No, now just Thompson Island.
And Thompson Island. Okay, so, but if you look at the if you look at his trajectory, he's gone from very big organizations to regional organizations, and now runs two brew pubs on the coast of Delaware. And so he's had quite a lot of different safety experiences from that. Next to him, we have Brian Confer. I met Brian at last year's CBC. He came up to me and very honestly said, you know, where are all the resources that I need? And we got chatting, and he was all fired up when he left CBC and instituted a new program that he's going to tell you about today to amp it up, to bring his safety program to the next level. He's a co-founder and head brewer at Storm Cloud Brewing, somewhere in the far distant northwest Michigan, near the water somewhere in a town nobody knows. But he's got a brew pub facility, and that was going so well, they added a production facility on top of that and are now looking to expand that operation. They've pulled down a bunch of GABF medals, and I can't wait to hear more from Brian. Abby here is a friend of mine I met on my first year tour of doing safety ambassador talks. I was in Duluth in 2015, and I met Abby, and there's a thing that happens with safety nerds. They can find each other in a crowd, and we became fast friends and have stayed in touch over the years. Abby is a real safety influencer, in addition to working as a senior risk consultant for Gallagher, which offers all sorts of management services and loss control services for businesses. She has a background in construction safety. She has a number of different social media things that she does, but Safety Justice League is a podcast of hers, and if you're not familiar with it, you know, catch up with her after the fact here. Safety Justice League, a great podcast. She has some really great speakers and content there for you. After that, let me introduce Rachel Bell. She's the co-chair of the Brewers Association Safety Subcommittee and recently became safety specialist for Canarchy. She's based in Salt Lake City and has three facilities in the Salt Lake area, but facilities in the southeast and all over, because it's a brewing conglomerate of craft breweries. And so she's got a lot of work ahead of her to look at the safety programs at each of those different individual breweries, and I presume try to bring them all under one heading. Yeah. And but prior to that, she was in a couple of different small breweries in the Salt Lake area. She also has experience at Von Trapp up in Stowe, Vermont. And prior to that, where I first met Rachel, she was at Monday Night Brewing in Atlanta. So, and she came up and met me in Salt Lake a few years ago and said, "Remember when we met in Atlanta? I'm still interested in safety." And one of the things that Rachel really brings is she's got 2 degrees in anthropology. And as we're going to touch on midway here, a lot of what makes a safety improvement possible in your business is an understanding of what culture is what your company culture and safety subculture of your company culture. And that's human being stuff. That's behavioral stuff. It's sociological. So she's got great influence there. And then finally, Jeff Mason. Jeff is a many hat wearer at Ska Brewing, which you may not know is also Ska Stillery and Ska Fabrication. So they're making equipment for brewery packaging and so forth, as well as making all sorts of great beers out in Durango, Colorado. And you guys have a still pub operation in, is it Boulder? You did. Okay. News to me. Sorry. That stuff happens. And then, but prior to that, he had some time in Sierra Nevada for quite a few years in facilities. And I guess you originated in Chico, yeah? You went to school in Chico. Yeah. And Jeff's built a program at SCA that's really fun and interesting. We'll hear about that too. Before we get into the topic of conversations, let me just say that we'd like, in as much as this is being recorded and will be available in perpetuity on the BA website, let's understand this as a space of non-criticism, a safe space, so that if our panelists offer an example here, we take it as constructive information so that we can use it productively going forward. It's easy to sometimes have a little bit of nervous laughter about something being done unsafely, but we'll grant you that. But at the same time, one of the most important fundamentals of improving a safety program is learning from what has happened. And so we're going to touch on some of those today, and we encourage you, to the extent that you're comfortable with that, to enter the conversation during Q&A and talk to us. And if that makes you nervous, we'll linger around afterwards, and you can hit us one-on-one for a little what I call safety confessional moment. If you want to just do that and say, we've got a problem, and I just want to talk one-on-one about that, and we'll all be very delighted to do that with you. Okay, so we've got three parts today, really two big parts, and then a wrap-up, a benediction, if we're going to have this as Safety Church. What did safety look like in your earlier experiences? And I'm not going to make any of our panelists parse out exactly which place they were at. It might be the place they're currently at that, back in the day. It might be other places they've had experience working. But what we're trying to capture in the first half here is a sense of what does safety really look like for most breweries as a sort of a dysfunctional, partial safety program? Where are most of us? What does that look like? What are we succeeding at getting that's only part of the picture? And what do we want that we're not getting? And be able to sort of air those ideas. We'll take a short diversion where I'm going to talk about safety culture and give us some common terms to use when we're talking about safety culture and the behavioral aspect of it. And then we'll go to the second part, which will be about what these guys have done to make improvements. And again, it's not to have achieved whatever this ultimate safety program is, but to make things better and what sort of things they focused on. Sound good? Okay, great. So, in general, guys, here we're looking at, was there a concern for safety? What was the state of safety early on in your earlier experiences? Did it exist? Was it a profane subject? Was it something nobody knew how to tackle? Who wants to jump in the mix here right at the beginning? Jeff, go ahead.
Good morning, all. First, I'd like to make an observation. This is not a criticism, but if this was like a typical safety meeting, everybody's spread out like a safety meeting. We hardly have anyone here in front of us. Everybody's as far away as possible.
They were afraid we were going to ask them a question.
I'm in a very comfortable area here, seeing the group set up like this. But I started in craft brewing, you could say, in the Stone Age days in January of 1987, and before microbreweries or craft breweries really existed. And I came from retail management, so I knew nothing about production or manufacturing or chemistry other than college chemistry, no real application. And so my very first week at that employer, I was instructed to clean some filter plates. And there's these 40 by 40 centimeter filter plates. We put them in a 55-gallon drum, filled the thing up with boiling hot water, and I was told, go get a scoop of that stuff in that drum and put it in there. Well, it was sodium hydroxide with the name Blast Off. So I went and got a big old scoop and dumped it in this tub of boiling hot water, and everybody knows, right, what's going to happen. And it exploded and hit me right here in my right eye. So my first week in the brewing industry, I had a burned off cornea. And of course, you'll be fine, just rinse it off. And it just got worse and worse. And so after a couple hours, I was finally taken to the health clinic, and that's where he said, your cornea is gone. and so had to take some time to have that heal. So that was eye-opening to me. And, you know, those early days, and I think now in a lot of the small startup breweries and brew pubs, there's still that bravado and the mindset of, it can't happen to me, safety is stupid, it's for other people, and why would I do this? I'm tougher than this. You know, I'm not going to fall off the ladder or the roof. I'm not going to trip over a hose. I'm not going to burn my eyes out. So there was definitely, and I'm sure there still is, like I said, that kind of culture. And it took some time and some work and actually hiring a safety manager when I was at Sierra to get people to actually understand. And I'll get more to that, I think, as we talk, of how you actually make those changes. It's not about guards on the grinder. It's not about wearing safety glasses. There's a lot more to it to get people to actually care about their own safety and behave in a safe manner.
Thanks, Jeff. Jimmy?
I just want to say, Jeff, I think Blast Off is probably the worst name for a cleaning chemical ever. That's just hilarious. When I started at Heineken UK in Manchester, the UK safety, like their version of OSHA, is way stricter than ours. Here, like, you know, for example, forklift certification, it's up to the company to determine who is certified on a forklift, whereas over there, this is exactly who is and how you do it, and that's with everything. Every little thing is spelled out. This is how you do it. There is no deviation, so there's no you work it out for how it works best for you over there. So then when I came over here, back to the States, and a couple, you know, and started off at... and some breweries over here where the safety was half-assed and just a hodgepodge of no centralization. It's like, oh, we kind of do this, we kind of do that. And there wasn't really no direction at all, which meant that it wasn't being thought about. And coming from the UK where everything was so tightly spelled out for you, it frightened me. I remember seeing somebody dry hopping a tank by climbing up to the top of the fermenter and pouring the hops into the top. And their harness was a rope that they had tied around their waist and then tied to the top of the tank. And it was like, nobody wants to fall with that on around their waist. He's going to actually hurt himself probably worse than if he just hit the ground. So it was obviously just kind of going through the motions without ever really thinking about the consequences. And what scared me most about that is safety. Like Jeff, you were saying, the safety is about people. You know, these are our friends. These are our coworkers. And it has to be the number one priority because there's no hitting your production goals, winning that medal, whatever. None of that is worth having one of your coworkers get blinded or possibly even die or get third-degree burns all over their body. It's absolutely not. And so it has to trump everything. If you got guys who are tired, then maybe you might need to like stop for the day and take care of this dry hopping tomorrow or something like that. It has to trump the schedule. It has to trump, you know, production plans. It has to trump everything. So, yeah, that's where I come from on it.
Thanks a lot, Jimmy. Great stuff. Anybody else want to talk about their early days? Brian.
Yeah, you know, I'm at another end of the spectrum to understand where our safety program was in our original pub brewery. I can tell you that I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts from five blocks away at Minneapolis College of Art and Design, so that did not adequately prepare me for things like capital raises and spreadsheet work and safety programs. So, you know, I've sat on that side of this table for 7 years at every safety conference I could go to, and every year, I'm a little less horrified at my internal feelings at what our safety program is. And we're getting it up to speed now, but it's taken a lot of time, and it's just taken time to get to that space. When we opened our production facility, I was dedicated to try to get that program in place, and I was at a Michigan chapter of the Master Brewers Association, and those meetings in Michigan are often run by very intelligent people from Bell's and Founders. And John Mallett often opens the meetings with a safety moment. And he introduced the topic at that day, saying that he feels his responsibility, his main responsibility at Bell's, is to make sure all his employees go home with the same number of fingers and toes that they started the day with. And I, for whatever reason, that just really resonated with me, and we were opening the production facility and decided to just actively get this program going.
Thanks, Brian. Rachel?
Yeah, thank you. So I first got into safety. I was fortunate because of two things. Number one, I got into this industry. I was a home brewer, and then I got a summer internship at my first brewery, and that was awesome, and that kind of showed me, I'm like, oh, commercial brewing can be just as fun as home brewing. It's just totally different, and I want to do it. So obviously started off in packaging part-time after my internship ended. But I still had that sort of that privilege of connection. Like, I had, you know, met our brewmaster, and I knew the owners of the company, whereas the other part-time packaging people absolutely didn't. A lot of them were people just coming in, like, they didn't even know what they were going to be doing that day. They would show up in tennis shoes, and you know, when they did that, people would be like, okay, so tomorrow, like, you need to do this, and you need to get yourself some boots, and things like that. But the other privilege I had was that the brewmaster and the head brewer both had seen some shit. And I think that's a big distinction when you're coming into a brewery. If the leadership has experienced safety issues, or they've, even if it hasn't happened to them, if they've seen it, it makes them more aware of safety, even if it's not in a way that I think we all are familiar with now. They're still looking out for people, and they're enforcing certain things that mean something to them because of their experiences. But sometimes going into brewery, the people that we work for have been lucky enough to not have seen some shit, but that actually is worse for the company because, you know, they're like, oh, it's fine. Like, I know you hear about these stories about, like, boilovers or getting caustic in your eye, but it's fine. That doesn't happen here. But it can happen there. So I was coming into it with hearing some horror stories. One of the things that I was told is all the equipment in this brewery is good at two things, making beer and killing humans. And so that was my introduction into breweries, and I was actually kind of afraid for a while. But that was good, you know, that made me want to educate myself further. But anyway, so I was on the packaging line doing stuff and just realizing that no one around me really understood what was happening, not just with safety, but with the beer they couldn't have named our core beers and things like that. So I really pushed to try to educate my coworkers. And then we had an actual safety incident that OSHA got involved with. And after that, you saw everybody, like, really start to be like, okay, we need to be very official with safety. We need to make sure that we know what we're doing with it now. And so I spoke up on behalf of packaging, because I was like, everyone, like, we're always getting left out of stuff. So I'd like to make sure we have a representative from packaging if you're making a safety committee. And their response was, you're the only person who seems to care, so you should run the safety committee. And it just kind of took off from there and ended up gravitating into safety being my primary function. But yeah, so that was early days for me. Unfortunately, even with that experience of, like, we've seen some shit, it still was more reactive than proactive. But that did change. That did get turned around.
Thanks, Rachel. And Abby, I'm going to put you on the spot. I know you've worked with a number of breweries as a consultant. Tell us about some of those early things that you saw.
Yeah, so my experience is here local. I was a safety consultant at the time, working for myself and living in Northeast Minneapolis, which is like the epicenter of craft brewing here in the area. I think it still is. Has the most breweries. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool? I could do safety for brewers. And so I should go knock on some doors and, you know, see what kind of business I could drum up. And so I did my first safety stalker move, which I always do when I'm looking into a new industry or a new company, as I go to the OSHA establishment search website. And so anyone can do that. You could just search up OSHA establishment search. And I typed in brewery and brewing in two different searches and searched it for Minnesota. and was surprised to find that a bunch of local craft breweries were getting inspected and cited by Minnesota OSHA. It was almost like it was a plan, although it wasn't a plan. It was a sneaky plan, if it was a plan, just in the Minnesota OSHA office. So I did some math. I took those numbers to the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild and said, what are you doing for safety? And at that time, they didn't have a safety committee. They didn't really have much going on for safety. There were some safety-minded folks, and even a couple people locally that were safety professionals for breweries, for some of the larger breweries. So we got together and started putting together resources. So kind of like you said, the reactive and proactive, like we did some reacting. You know, there's OSHA inspections, there's citations. Some of the members were dealing with some things in the moment. But then we tried to move it around so people could become more proactive and give people tools that they could use to start up their safety programs. And I just saw a sketchy on the screen, and that was always my mindset. I'd come into a brewery and I'm like, all right, what's the sketchiest thing that you do here? Like, let's talk about that first and make sure you have a procedure, and then we'll go from there. So just a little bit about my background and just where we started here in Minnesota.
Thanks very much, Abby. So if I synthesize from what I just heard, each had some sort of an influence that drove them to say, I need to improve my safety program. You know, Jimmy came from the UK where their HSE, which is their OSHA, is just, you know, on a completely different level. If you've ever taken a brewery tour in Great Britain, you know you're issued a high-vis vest and safety glasses, and you stick with the leader, and nobody strays, and, you know, all this good stuff.
And you're not carrying a beer with you either.
That's right. That's right. Nope. Maybe a tasting later when it's all said and done. You know, Rachel had was in response to an OSHA issue. In Minnesota, there was some sort of what we were going to call an emphasis program where OSHA had looked at an industry and targeted lots of people in that industry. They hadn't told anybody about that. You know, there's a good thing that we'll talk about later about how to know that's coming. Brian comes from no safety or technical mechanical background. You know, he makes good beer, but didn't have that. And so, Jeff was motivated by a personal injury right from the get-go. So any of these things might be what it takes to get the gospel on this. You don't have to have any of those. Maybe just being here today, you're going, okay, we need to up our game. So let's find out what that looks like. Before we move on, is there any one thing? I mean, I think some of you have kind of leaned towards it. Is there any one thing you said, if we're going to get started, let's start here? Where did you start? I think Rachel said safety committee, and you ended up, you know, getting voluntold to run it. From coming from that position of not really knowing enough about safety or not having enough of a safety program, where did you go next? You know, what was your first step? Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, you just kind of danced around it, but the first thing you have to do is talk. It's the communication thing. You have to get people together, and you have to get them to tell you what's wrong and what they think solutions might be. And that can be hard because a lot of times it's creating communication pathways that did not previously exist. So like me trying to get a voice for the part-time packagers who were most at risk and had no idea. But also people, you have to have every department involved. And a lot of breweries, like, we don't really have a direct line from like a salesperson to a brewer or someone in the cellar. And of course you have to have your ownership or management, whoever is making those financial decisions, like they have to buy in, and a lot of people might not have access to that person regularly. So like open those communication pathways first so you know what's going on and what you need to fix.
Thanks. So any of the others here, how did you get started, Jeff?
Okay, so hopefully, Dave Thibodeau, my boss, is here, so hopefully I don't get fired after this talk. But
he values your honesty.
It was coming. So I would say, and this isn't just SCA, but at Sierra also, it's the importance of safety. So in our employee handbook, the very first page is a statement from Dave Thibodeau, the owner of the brewery, on the importance of safety and that everyone that works there is a safety person. So the employees knowing how important that is and making it personal that you care. The second thing would be training, making sure. So part of the main part of our new employee onboarding is talking about safety and HAZCOM and all that stuff. And so they get an understanding because a lot of people that have this dream of getting into craft brewing haven't done it or they don't know the dangers. And like I was said, yes, all the machines are out there to kill you. That's what they want to do. And so you're going to try to prevent that. And the other thing would be making it personal. So having people tell their stories. And so I'll tell people my story. There is a very valuable, couple of valuable resources, one that costs money. There's a guy named Charlie Moorcraft, if anyone's ever heard of Remember Charlie. This is an expensive DVD you buy. We don't have one at SCA, not yet. But and it's a story of a guy in 1980 who was working for Exxon. And he was just a regular blue-collar worker. You know who he is, huh? Yeah. And he was, I think it was in California, it doesn't matter where he was, but he was a worker at a refinery. He was getting ready to leave on vacation with his family, and he got a call, hey, we need this work being done on this one valve pipeline. He's like, oh, crap, I want to get out of town. So he rushes down there, and he had all the training he needed. He had all of the tools that he needed, everything he needed to do this job safely. But he's like, I've done this a million times. I'm just going to not do my lockout, tagout. I'm not going to seal off this line. And he opened the wrong thing, and kaboom, the guy was burned over half his body. And so when I was at Sierra, we had this video. It was like a part of orientation for production employees. And you got these rough and tough guys and gals in there, like, you know, the kind of, it will never happen to me, or nothing will really affect me. And you look around the room as this guy's talking, and there are tears coming down. And, I mean, every time, I probably saw it 100 times, and every time I'd get choked up on this guy's story. Another one that it will not cost you anything other than you have to be able to get to YouTube is actually from the craft industry. There was a practice at Stone Brewing Company. When a new employee comes on, they have them with a beer out in the beer garden, and they're having their beer, and they interview them and talk about yourself. And there's a young man named Matt Courtright whose dream was to work for Stone Brewing Company. And so they do this interview and everything like that. And one day, he was in the warehouse driving the forklift, and because he was going to go move some pallets, and a little bit later, somebody came out, and they found him mousetrapped under the forklift, dead. And so this video, even though it's the video is about the beer that they made in his memory, it's called Matt's Burning Roses. So if you look that up, it's really sad, but it's really powerful. And so at SCA, we did have a warehouse supervisor who was very reluctant to wear the seatbelt on his forklift. And I'd got him on over and over. You got to wear this. You have no idea. He's like, oh, if this thing goes over, I'll just jump out. I'm like, dude, it doesn't work that way. And I showed him that video, and from that day on, and so we show that to folks when they're getting their forklift certification. But it's powerful, and it's personal. It's in the craft brewery. It's what everybody does. And a young man died. So use those resources to make it personal. Your story, someone else's story, that people get it, that, yeah, this could be life-ending. We also talk about what happens if you lose an eye. Okay, yeah, you don't think you want to wear your safety glasses? And OSHA or workers' comp's going to take care of you if you injure your eye, but what if you can't work for 6 months? Now you can't pay your rent, can't pay your mortgage. What's your significant other going to think when you can't work anymore? Those are real things, and I think getting it personal like that can be very impactful.
Good. Yeah. Brian, do you have something?
So, again, it seems so basic, but whatever your guys' program is, it can't be much less than where ours was. When we transitioned out of the pub brewery and into the production brewery, even before equipment was in the production facility, the first thing I did was install safety glass holders at both entrances. And even though we weren't doing a great job of wearing PPE and safety glasses at the pub, every time we went into the production facility to do some prep work there or bring in a tank, we always put on our safety glasses. That's honestly where our program started. And once you got your guys doing that every day, were in their brewing. It's just, it formed a habit, and it also sets the ground to bring in the next thing. Not wearing shorts on a hot, humid day. I've heard you talk about that.
Right.
You know, you can start to bring in the next step and the next step.
So part of where you found yourself were we just didn't know what to do right. But did any of you encounter a workplace where safety was actually a joke? Safety was viewed negatively? Yeah. How do you turn that one around? Jeff?
So those personal incidents, typically it takes somebody to get hurt bad in order for folks to decide this could actually happen. And at those early days at my previous employer, the packaging manager, they were having trouble in packaging with a case sealer. So it was a big belt-driven thing with the arm and gluing and stuff. And the belt needed to be aligned. Everybody went to break, and so the packaging manager decided, I can tune this in. He didn't turn the machine off. He didn't, you know, any of that. And he went in to reach for an adjustment, and his arm got caught in the belt and actually made a U-turn all the way around as he was screaming and almost took his arm off. That got pretty real for folks. But, you know, even after that, safety was seen as like this stupid thing. It's like, you know, you go to a safety meeting, it was like, I have to go. And it wasn't personal. But when those things do happen, unfortunately, I think people do see that and change the mindset.
Thanks. Jimmy.
Yeah, well, I didn't have anywhere where it was viewed as a joke within the organization, but one of the things that I've noticed is that when you got guys who have been doing this or gals who have been doing this for 10, 15 years or something, and they're like, oh, I know this. I know how to do this, and I haven't gotten hurt yet. That is actually a lot of times the most experienced brewers who are the most reckless and the most dangerous and the most at risk of being hurt. Whereas the new guys, you know, if you've got a safety program up and running, you can instill into them from day one that safety is important. And those who have been around for a while, they have to unlearn their bad habits and then come on board with the new program. And that can sometimes be very, very difficult. They're like, oh, I've been doing this. I don't need to wear that. I know when I can and can't wear my safety glasses. It's fine. You know, I'm fine wearing shorts on a hot day. I don't have to wear long pants. It's really uncomfortable. I know what I'm doing. And you have to actively undo that. You can't let that slide. Sure, this is my head brewer. He's been with us from day one. He really does know what he's doing. He actually needs to be, those guys who have been there forever, they need to be leaders. They need to be examples and bring the rest of the crew on board with them. Otherwise, people start going, I don't have to do it. So-and-so is not doing it. I'm not doing it either. You know, he thinks he's immune to it. So that was an encounter that I had at some places where it wasn't so much within the entire organization, but there were certainly key players that thought that they were exempt from it. And you gotta quash that shit right away.
Right, thanks, Jimmy. Anybody else want to add? Abby, go ahead.
Quick. My background's construction safety, and a lot of those folks, they identify, like, their identity is their job. Like, I'm an iron worker, and, you know, that's what an iron worker looks like, what they sound like, and, you know, it's a whole persona. So same thing with brewers, right? So I am a fan of using, you know, horrible stories, like the scared straight kind of thing. But, you know, people, we remember Charlie and then we forget, you know, we go on with work and we don't have like those horrible stories right at the top of our head. And so then I like to take it to a more like maybe positive route where it's like, you like this industry, you like brewing, you like being the head brewer or whatever you are. You know, don't you want to do that for a while? Or don't you want to have a say with when you're done doing that? And so if we approach it like it's longevity in your career, and, you know, we can give the stats about like workers' comp and how that doesn't pay the bills and all that too, to give people like a holistic understanding of safety. But sometimes I like to go positive also. And then it's easier for those people with the experience to impart that positive mentality. Like, hey, I love this job. I want to keep doing this. So, you know, the way that we do that is we do these things safely. We don't just reach into things without closing them down.
Thanks, Abby. I noticed nobody's, we're going to go to Rachel next, but I just made the observation that nobody yet has talked about cost as being the real reason you couldn't get a safety program going. You know, I mean, I think there's a mythology that a lot of us have that, you know, safety somehow costs something that we didn't put in our prospectus, but so far it's been avoided. We've got lots of other good reasons that safety was failing. Rachel, go ahead, please.
Yeah, just related back to what we were just talking about, I think it's important to understand what would best motivate the person who does not want to be compliant with safety. Someone touched on that they need to, if it's, you know, a head brewer or someone like that, that they need to be a leader. Some people actually do respond well to that if you remind them that, like, you know, all these people coming up, like, they're looking up to them, and they don't know what you know. Like, they don't have your experience, so, like, you need to show them how to be safe because, you know, how bad will you feel if they're copying you and they get hurt and their life is impacted forever because you set a bad example? And that actually can go a long way. I've seen that work. A lot of times it is actually like getting management involved. I've had to do that. I've had people laugh in my face when I tell them, like, you cannot be in here wearing shorts in the cellar. They're like, ha, you can't tell me that. And like, literally, I don't know how he convinced them, but I, you know, had to get ownership involved and make it real for them, I guess. Like, there would be some kind of consequence if you don't follow these pretty basic rules. but I think another big motivator is we're fortunate that, like, a lot of the rock star brewers and people in the industry in the BA, they all really care about safety. And I think, like, they set a good example. It's like, oh, like, if you want to be considered at the same, you know, notoriety and quality of these brewers, like, do what they do, and they include safety. Safety is tied to quality. Matt and I say this all the time, but it really is. There's so many best safety practices that tie in with quality and organization and things like that. And that is another potentially good argument to motivate people.
Thanks, Rachel. That's a really good point. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing, a free thing, and from what Abby was saying about accentuate the positive. So we have... in our safety committee, everyone's assigned every month to at least find someone to great catch them. And so you're looking for someone that's doing things in a safe manner, and you're like, oh, great catch. And then as a safety committee, we get together every month, and we talk about the folks, hopefully there's more than one, that got a great catch, and we vote on the monthly safety star, and they get a gift card, $20, $25 gift card to a local business. They could spend, we take their picture, we put them in the HR newsletter, here's our safety star. So we also do that, and that's pretty low cost to do something like that.
Thanks, Jeff, very much. Brian, go ahead.
No, I wasn't.
Nope. Oh, just really quick, because
sure.
At breakfast we were talking about this. You guys all might be thinking, oh, if we go a whole month without an accident, we get a pizza party. Don't do that. We all were at breakfast and all decided that we all are against that. What happens if people just stop reporting accidents? So things like that, you know, watch how you're doing the positive reinforcement. I think that the catch of the month, that's a great way of doing it. But trying to do like, oh, we all get a gift card or a big party if we don't have any accidents for a month or 6 months, people will just not report the accidents because they don't want to be the guy to ruin everybody's pizza party. So, yeah.
Everybody.
It's a common one, so I just wanted to point that out specifically. Yeah.
We're not against pizza, however. I'm a very pizza-motivated individual. So just find something else to measure and something else to celebrate. So if you're having issues with like a certain type of PPE that people are struggling with, you know, wearing what they're supposed to wear, then maybe put some kind of metric around it or great catch kind of program around it, measure that and put that as a goal, and then have your pizza.
Super. All good points and a lot of positives mentioned there. Before we go to part two, I've got this graphic up here, and I think it's fair to say from what I've heard in your early experiences, you know, having some training, having equipment ready, you know, focusing on that safety stuff is what we thought was going to create a safety program and a safe workplace. Is that fair, that in the early days, or let's say in a dysfunctional safety program, we think it's all about safety, right? You've said things about it's about management support, it's about communication between each other, it's about positive reinforcement. I mean, those aren't safety things, right? Those are just ways that we can interact. Okay, I just wanted to see if we agreed on that. Okay, and we've had some of these great examples that you guys already beat me to the punch. So let's go into part two here. where we're going to talk a bit about culture. And I'm using this expression here, which I found in The Alchemy of Leadership, transforming leader thinking into the gold of wisdom. The phrase that caught my attention was that culture is the crucible of change. And here we've got a crucible. But in reality, culture is, it's only a virtual crucible. Culture is not it's not a department. It's not a written program. It's not a plan. You know, it's not tangible. And that's why we have trouble getting our heads around it. So let me propose something that we've been using this graphic a lot this week. And my colleague, Dr. J, and I talk about this. You know, she's in diversity and equity. And we're like absolutely in 100% agreement on this, that whatever the behavioral outcome that we're looking for is underlain by other things. It's not just behavior. Behavior comes from something. And in the case of safety, safe behavior is what creates safe workplace. Would you agree? Like when we act safely, safe things happen. When we act unsafely, there's a chance that something goes wrong. Now, there is also mechanical failure and things like that, and you know, humans may be directly related or more distantly related, but ultimately, safe behavior in the workplace results in a safe workplace, and we can call those outcomes, safe outcomes. But where does behavior come from? Why do we do the things we do, is the question. And what Dr. J and I agree on is that we do the things we do because of what we believe and what we perceive and what we feel. Right? If I give you a choice between, you know, a trash bin and a recycling bin, and they're side by side, and we haven't been very good at sorting them at my place, and I put up a sign there that says, you know, you'll be written up if you don't sort your recyclables. I'm attacking the behavior, right? I see a behavior that I'm not happy with because we're not sorting well. The behavior is the doing. We're not doing it well. And then I put up a sign that says, do it differently. I'm trying to change it on the behavioral level. And I think you all see that sign's not going to have much effect. It might even have a reverse effect. Like, screw you, I'm putting everything in the recycling, even if it's, you know, rotten food. So we have to get to the beliefs and the values and the perceptions, and these things collectively make up our culture. And those beliefs, where does it come from that we believe the thing we believe? So if I am a person who sorts my recycling well, I have an underlying belief somewhere. It might be this is good for the planet, or it's a moral obligation. Those kind of things are beliefs. And when I have fixed on one of those that supports putting the recycling in the right bin, then I've affected behavior by way of belief. And that's going to have much more impact on my behavior than a sign that says change your behavior. One of the common examples is Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs campaign, which was largely considered a flop. You know, if she had said, say yes to a healthy lifestyle, it might have had a different outcome, right? But just to target the behavior doesn't get us there. So we have to understand the beliefs and the values, but those things come from somewhere. Why do we believe the things we believe? And we believe them because we experience them. Why does Jeff believe that caustic is injurious to the eye? His experience taught him that, right? Or we get vicarious experience by saying, don't stick your hand in an unlocked out mechanical device because this happened to that guy. So that's vicarious experience, but it's still experience. How do we learn these experiences? How do we share them? Through socialization. See, so it really does come down to sociology and human interaction. So when we set the right example, for example, when somebody's doing donuts on the forklift with somebody riding on the forks, not that you've ever seen or done anything like this, but it becomes really funny and somebody makes a video capture on their phone and then they all share it with each other and that becomes funny amongst your social group. That's the foundation of future behavior. You created this, that this is okay. This is how we do it here. Now, it's okay to have an edgy beer brand We're going to get into branding your safety program in a minute. Surly, right here in Minnesota, had a program called the Danger Rangers, right? They were surly, right? They're kind of, you know, have an edgy brand. But the Danger Rangers fit into that culture, but it was designed to alter behavior in the correct direction, you know, and make things safer. So that was how they branded their safety program. So keep that in mind. And any of the stories that you hear today or the ones that you're thinking about for yourself right now, say, okay, I understand the, you know, when the fellow at Stone died in the forklift, there were a number of different behaviors that he had engaged in that led to that. He didn't have a seatbelt on. He was driving with a heavy load high. He turned a corner at a high rate of speed. Those are behaviors. He might not have had a good belief system that was unsafe because he might not have had enough experience on a forklift or enough training. I can't speak to that. But there was something, it wasn't just the forklift, you know what I'm saying? Right? There was a series of behaviors that had this terrible outcome. So think about each of those as we're going forward. What we're going to do next is talk to our panelists about how they brought in the non-safety stuff to build their programs and become more successful in that. So, and then we'll come, we've just got a couple slides here to go, and we'll begin to take questions. So, first of all, for the panelists, how did you begin to elevate your safety program? Did it come from ownership saying, from now on we're doing things this way, or was it a groundswell? Was it insidious amongst your workforce? Jimmy.
At one of the breweries that I worked at, it was basically put on me. I went to ownership and said, this is horrible. And they said, well, you're the production manager. Do what you think is right. And I said, that's great. That's what I want to do. And I started with writing a safety manual, saying, you know, put it all in writing and making sure that we're all on the same page, that we are all in agreement that this is what we need to do. But before I even started to write that, it was, I need you guys to be 100% on board with this. I need ownership to be supportive and not coming down and trying to, like, oh, let's just, that's going to be too expensive, just keep doing it, or, you know, let's just get it done however you can, as quickly as you can. We need to get this beer out. I need you guys to acknowledge that safety really is our priority and make it a part. Because a lot of times, you know, you were talking about beliefs and values, and when you join an organization, a lot of times the ownership has already written those. They have their core values, they have their beliefs, they have written out in part as part of their business plan. So they've already sort of established that. So in a sense, a lot of times it needs to help come from ownership. But then also when I typed up the safety manual, the editing process was done by on the floor. And that was to get everybody on the floor on board as well. So to buy into this. This isn't me telling you what to do. This is us having a discussion about what needs to be done. We all know that there needs to be improvements. And what are those going to look like? So you come from both directions up into the middle. And it was hard. And there were some missteps as well. There were whole departments that I forgot about, like the tap room, and had to bring them into it afterwards. It was like, oh my goodness, you're right, you know, because I was focused on the production floor. So we made some missteps, but you come from both directions, top down. Like you were saying about, you know, having like influencers, people who people look up to, making sure that they're wearing their glasses and everything. So it was like, as owners, the brewmaster, you guys really need to be on it with wearing those safety glasses and stuff like that, and act as examples as well. So like, even before I wrote the manual, it was get buy-in from the top level guys that everybody's looking up to, the ownership, and then work on the manual and bring the on the floor guys and come together. That's how I did it.
Great, Jimmy.
Okay.
Abby.
going with your visual, sometimes it's going to be like off balanced, right? Like sometimes you'll have horrible management that's like not coming to the middle, but you have people, you know, that are working day to day doing the things that they're very invested in safety because they don't want to get hurt. And so they're bringing up ideas or super engaged in a safety committee or safety team or danger rangers, danger dodgers. I've heard some other fun teams. So, you know, sometimes it's more from the ground up. And in my construction experience, that's how it was. I had a vice president of a company that would come out to do a job site visit with me in loafers and like Ray-Bans. And I was like, dude, you get to be in the golf cart then with me and have like, you know, the dignitary tour. And that looks so stupid. Like the optics are horrible with me driving the vice president of the company around in his, you know, outfit. So it's critical that the people that run the company, that they have some kind of visual with the company too, that they're coming to meetings or walking around and that they're geared up just like the workers are. I think, you know, PPE of course is like the last resort of safety controls, but it's the most visual and it's the thing that people see that you're not doing when you're walking around. So always make sure that your outfit's right. But if you find yourself in a position where management is not coming to the middle, it's just a matter of you kind of become a safety PR department then, that you're like, hey, look what we're doing. People have these great ideas. We're you know, seeing improvement in this and in that. So you might have to tailor like a reporting dashboard almost to that upper management person that isn't quite bought in or sold on what's going on, so that they see the good things and they want to get on board. So it's kind of a little backwards. But that's where most of my experience has been, is that it's from the ground up, unfortunately.
Thanks. Jeff, now, oh, go ahead, Rachel.
Go ahead, Rachel.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's going to get me later. two things have jumped to mind, and one is I've been in situations where management was saying, like, oh, safety is a priority. Just tell me what you need. You know, I'll find room in the budget for anything. And, of course, I go to him and be like, okay, we need it, you know, chemical shower, and we need an eyewash station beyond those little bottles. And he was like, oh, well, that's going to be like, dude, we can't do that. It's like, well, that's what we need. So I would say if there are leadership folks in the room, you know, even if you really don't have room in the budget for a crucial safety thing, you know, be honest about that, but be just try to keep track of that and make sure that you're not just saying a performative thing about safety. You know, there are a lot of small and easy fixes, and a lot of that is literally just it's helping to build the culture. It's that attitude. It's the way. It can just be talking about it. It can just be having those meetings and making sure that people are changing those behaviors. Because changing behaviors just takes time. That doesn't always take money. Yes, there are a lot of physical things that you might need to fix in your facility to make it safer. And just, you know, be honest with people and transparent about how you're saving for that and when you're going to get to it, and actually do it. Eventually follow through or show some steps along the way, because I think that goes a long way to show your employees that you are caring and you are trying to do something. But related to that, the biggest thing I hear with safety and with other, what I would consider kind of like some simple operational things to help everyone's job go smoother, it's the line of, oh, we're too small. Like, we're not a big brewery. We're a small brewery. We don't need that, or we don't have time for that, or... but there really are a lot of things that you can do that don't cost a lot of money to get organized and communicate better. Having a safety manual, I mean, so many breweries don't have any kind of introductory anything to welcome their employees besides, like, oh, just show up and we'll talk to you about some stuff. But writing an employee handbook includes safety in that. I mean, your thing about, like, the front page says that statement. That sets the tone for their entire time at the company. I mean, you do have to follow through and make sure it's not just a statement. But if you're taking the time to write that and have everyone sign off and read on it, you know, doing those little steps will help everybody buy in and believe it. And so I think that is a great place to start.
Thanks, Rachel. Jeff, I have a question for you. So you have this good catch reward that you were doing.
Yep.
Did you brand your safety program? Did you give it a name?
Safety program is No One Hurt.
No One Hurt.
So
what does branding a safety program do for you?
I think that gives a vision, a goal. You know, we've never had a year with no one hurt. Actually, we did. In 2020, we had no one, not a single accident, which is pretty incredible. But, yeah, you have to, I would say naming your program gives you a target, something to go for, something for people to attach to. But I would say when years ago we didn't have a lot of safety being practiced formally, and one of the things that we saw was safety glasses. Like Jimmy had mentioned safety glasses, we talk about culture. And you put the two things together. So the first thing you need is not just the leader of the safety department going, you guys must do this. You got to put your safety glasses on. It's getting champions. So if you can get some of your influencers in the company to buy in, and we did this, so we started with safety glasses, and we had it be the decision of the department supervisors that this is what we're going to do. So I had buy-in from them. They understood why, and then they spread that out through their team. Another thing I heard was, well, wait, yeah, good luck with that. We've got all these, you know, try to convince this guy to do that. Try to convince that guy to do that. They've been here forever. They're not going to change. So I would go build relationships with those employees and say, is this a problem? What do you think? And they're like, oh, yeah, this is a great idea, but that guy's not going to change. And so you go around and you talk to each person and you're building that influence by people to go, oh, yeah, no, I'm totally willing. I think that's a great idea.
Do you ever go to somebody and say, we heard that you were never going to wear safety glasses? Does that have a good effect?
Well, kind of like that. When you say you've been here a long time, you've probably never had to do this, but can you understand why this is important, what hydrogen peroxide could do to your eye or your face if you get it on not wearing that face shield? So being able, I do get and I understand the safety pyramid and how PPE is a last resort, but I see it as a key component because breweries are inherently dangerous. There's a lot of bad stuff there, and you can't out-engineer everything. There's always going to be an air gap between your bulk chemical and whatever that secondary container is. There's an opportunity. You can't out-engineer that without being something that's automated and very expensive. So I see PPE as a very important component to a safety program.
Great.
And it sets the mindset. When they're protecting themselves, they get it. And it's also keeping safety on people's mind. So if it's just something as simple as a startup meeting for packaging, every morning they get together and talk about, hey, by the way, we're doing this today. Watch out for this. Watch out for that. It just keeps people's mind on that, and maybe there's not the complacency that we typically see when people do have accidents.
Good. So, Brian, you came up with a name for your safety program.
Well, so the background on that is I, you know, we started with the safety glasses. We have developed a reasonably good, I'm pretty proud of our safety culture, but we're lacking compliance in a lot of areas. So I came out last year to CBC or in Denver to go to your safety boot camp, and intent on finally, I wanted to bring us into compliance. So we have a good safety program. The guys are committed to it. It's all about their safety, but I also want to be in compliant in the case of a visit. So I came out intending to go to your safety boot camp, but my real intent was to corner you and try to get some information about some better resources. And be careful when you do that, because you might find yourself on a panel. So I went back home to Michigan, and I with the idea that we were going to do a 12-month safety beauty makeover, which, you know, it kind of makes light of it, and I don't intend it to, but ultimately, at the end of 12 months, I just want our program to look a lot better on paper, really, and you know, fill the cracks that the areas that we're missing. So we before I even left Denver, I had made an appointment. We had done forklift training, but we weren't current on it because new guys start and they need to have a license. So I had already scheduled forklift training for basically the week that I got back from Denver. And then while that gentleman was there, I asked him to consult. And so he's coming in once a month and doing a safety training for us. So we've done, on the first Monday of every month, we do an hour or more, it depends on what it is. But we've done updated our forklift training. We've done aerial lift training because we got rid of ladders and got in an aerial lift. You'll see why we got rid of ladders shortly. We've done a confined space entry. We've done lockout, tagout, ladder safety. And then we have another 6 months to go yet. So in the end, we're going to do some first aid certification. And I thought we were going to do like an OSHA, my OSHA consult. But I think I might want to keep buttoning things up a little bit before we do that.
Sure. Great. Thanks, Brian. Anybody else want to talk about safety branding before we move on? Abby.
Not so much branding, but Jeff mentioned champions, and I just wanted to get into that a little bit more. Do you know how to find those champions? Like, how do you find those people that the others look to, but they're not their direct supervisor? So I just love observing people. Like, so if I have a new client, I'll just watch them have one of their regular meetings. And there's probably like an anthropology term for this, so don't laugh at me. So I'll watch these meetings, and if the person leading the meeting asks a question, nobody will offer an answer. They will, like, they don't even know they're doing this. They will look at somebody else to see, like, what's that person doing, you know? So those people are those champions, even though they may not be supervisors. People are looking to that person to know how to react.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks, Abby. Good point. So we've got a few minutes left before we go to questions. I wanted to kind of go to our third part here, which is even though you've seen all the effort that went into developing improved safety programs, things sometimes happen. So those of you who have a story to share, Jeff, I'm going to start with you. In just a minute.
Great, thanks.
That's going to go for everybody. In just a minute, tell us about OSHA's emphasis program in Colorado and how that worked out for you.
Yes, and well-deservedly so. So that OSHA had noticed in the craft brewing industry a lot of accidents were happening. And it was not just craft brewing, but craft wine, craft distilling, and craft ice. If there's anybody here in the craft ice industry, I've yet to meet a craft ice person. So they actually gave us a letter and said, we're going to do this regional inspection in the state of Colorado, and it's going to start this period and end this period. And we're like, holy crap, we got to start figuring out all this compliance stuff and everything they're going to look at. So I will tell you this is very important. And I don't know if Matt has this available, but the first thing I went to was the OSHA Handbook for Small Businesses. If you want to scare the crap out of yourself and feel completely overwhelmed, like, how in the heck, in this handbook, it's like, this is just, a little sampling of what you need to do. 42 categories, something like 57 million line items. And unlike a government document, when you read this, it's just like reading a book, not like a textbook where everything's numbered and lettered. So then I put that in an Excel spreadsheet, and actually the Colorado Brewers Guild put that into a Google Sheets for everyone to use. And so even though I did that, still feeling very overwhelmed, I reached out to Colorado State University, where they have a OSHA consultancy. And from what I understand, there's actually one of these in every single state. You call these people, they come to your brewery, and they actually do an OSHA inspection without a ticket book. But they will write you up, and I believe you can either get serious, other than serious, or recommended. And I think we had 18 things that were serious, that extension cords, rotating shafts, all these things. But it was the greatest thing. Unfortunately, you do have to fix these within a short period of time. Otherwise, legally, they're obligated to send this information to the OSHA with the ticket book. So we went through that, which was a fantastic experience. I felt that equipment-wise, material-wise, training-wise, all this stuff, our committee, everything improved from their visit. So we're like, whew, we got that out of the way. And then the time period went by. We didn't see OSHA. We're like, awesome. Well, they apparently didn't do the regional inspection during that time period. A year later, they said, hey, we're doing this again. And I don't know, it was like a month later, all of a sudden we get this. Somebody from the bar comes up and says, yeah, we have Hector from OSHA here. Who wants to do inspection, and we did have three violations, but I actually negotiated a smaller fine than they said, because Dave made me call them and try to negotiate, even though I was like, $2,500, man, this is nothing, we're so lucky, and I actually negotiated down to $1,200 fine, which I couldn't believe, but it ended up being a pretty good experience. Yeah, it's really weird to say. But an OSHA visit was probably, or the threat of one, was probably one of the greatest things that happened to us as far as the compliance side.
Thanks, Jeff, very much. Brian.
So, yeah, as I said, last year I was intent on getting this program started and attending safety boot camp. In an incredible dark case of serendipity, while I was at boot camp, we had a gentleman on staff fall off a ladder, just a simple six-foot folding ladder. And how bad could that possibly be? There it is. He basically, his foot got caught up in the ladder as he fell, so he went backwards, and it basically detached his ankle from his leg. There's like, I think I counted 14 screws in there. There might be more. But he was out all winter. He tried to come back last month, and he also hit his head on a keg as he came down, too. So he had, he's got a pretty bad head injury as a result. So he has not come back to the brewery. He tried and worked for about an hour and said he couldn't do it. But he's working in the pub. He's a valued employee. We're, you know, I was very sad to see that happen. But you know that we were already on course, so this wasn't like sort of a come to Jesus moment, but it was a kick in the pants for sure.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brian. Anybody else want to add? Jimmy, Rachel, go ahead.
So. I have two stories that relate to both of yours. I'm going to address the ladders first. So I had an instance at a brewery I worked at somewhat recently that was very close to my heart. Small brewery, around like 6,000 barrels annually. And our packaging manager fell off a ladder at home. He was hanging a pinata, was probably only like 3 or 4 feet off the ground, fell, awful fracture, bone through the skin, had to have multiple surgeries, had to have skin grafts because the surgeries didn't go right. He was out for over a year, basically. He could not come in and work. But for us as a company, the other side of that is he was the main packaging guy. He was honestly probably working like 60 hours a week, and there was like one kind of like part-time person helping him. And so head brewer, head cellarman, me, we were all like kind of taking turns trying to run the packaging line, trying to do packaging. I was coming in on weekends to do variety packs by myself. And the other side of that, like, we felt so bad for him because we loved him. He was like a part of our, you know, our team. But also just the cost, I mean, you know, thank God it didn't happen at work, but it shouldn't have happened at all. And so the impact of an injury like that, it messed us up for a while, business-wise and also personally. So that's the other side of the injuries themselves.
We experienced that as well, because we didn't want to fill his position out from under him. We waited for him to come back all winter long and ran short-handed, and was really excited about him coming back to work. And, you know, justifiably, he couldn't do it. And so now we're down a guy. So that's the other side of it, in a time when it's hard to find help.
Yeah. Oh, real quick, so the other part, I have worked for a brewery that also did the consultation program, and it was great. I tried to get us to a higher level first, because I tried to warn them. I'm like, they're going to find stuff that you are going to have to put money into fixing in a set time frame. But I think that was also good. It kind of forced them to finally follow up, and it validated a lot of the things that I had been trying to say that we need. But the other thing, I mean, OSHA's going to be so stoked to hear from you. They're like, yes, somebody cares. Someone's being proactive. You can also call them anonymously and ask direct questions. Just be like, hey, like, I don't want to say who I work for, but I just have this question. Like, is this compliant? And they will also be super stoked that you're taking the initiative to ask them about that. And final thing about OSHA, if you can show that you have put some effort in, that you are trying, they are going to be way more willing to work with you and to negotiate down fines. So, you know, even if, like, say you can't afford to get a certified forklift trainer on site, but if you can prove that, you know, the person who's doing the trainings, like, they've educated themselves, they've been driving forklifts for this long, you have documentation, like, this is what they teach, this is how they teach it, that could potentially fly. Like, if you can make the case that you've put that work in. So I would say for some more expensive things, you know, don't put it off. Just because, don't say, like, oh, we can't afford it. Let's not do anything. At least put some of that effort in and try. And if you do get inspected, that will go a really long way.
Thanks, Rachel. Well, I know everybody else has stories, too. We're going to go on to the last slide, which I'm just going to put up here momentarily, and then we'll take your questions. And this was, you know, I didn't tell these folks what to say here, but if you distill down what you've heard in the last hour here, you're going to find out that they're saying management support is essential, communication, it's all about communication throughout the entire organization, being able to hold people responsible for the things they do well and reward them or acknowledge them, and sometimes have to make difficult decisions about people who don't get on board, involving everybody from the workforce, and then competence, which would be things like training. Brian didn't mention it, but a little bit he did, I guess, bringing in an outside expert. You know, you don't have to have the competence yourself. OSHA compliance, OSHA consultation inspections are another way of bringing expertise in, and maybe your workers' comp provider also has expertise that you can draw from. So with that, we'll encourage you to do what these folks have done, and we're delighted to get to questions. We've got quite a few. We won't get to them all, but what we will do is promise you a written digest of all the questions, which we'll announce on the BA forum. And that you should, even if we answer your question today, you should look into that, because we'll put live links into those answers so you can have resources to go from. Is there any form of punishment you'd recommend for employees that do not comply or practice safety requirements? We'll try to keep these real short.
Now, can I make, you said I would have time for my final, like, little pearl of wisdom. Do I have time for that before we get to questions?
Go ahead, Jeff. Okay.
So one of the things we didn't talk about, we did talk about behavior and what influences behavior. Are there things in your brewery that can either inhibit safe practice or improve safe practice that aren't directly related to that? And I will tell you, there is a big one, and that is housekeeping. So, you know, we know that most accidents happen, slips, trips, and falls due to complacency. It's typically your employees that have been there 2 to 5 years that are seasoned. They're kind of used to doing everything right. But housekeeping is super important. And I noticed this phenomena that they don't teach you if you've ever taken a physics class in college or a general relativity. You would know that there's 19 physical constants in the universe, correct? Well, there's actually a 20th that you've never learned. And I noticed this when I was working at my previous employer, that wherever there is a flat surface, people put crap on it. So I came up with this term, flat surface crap, as the 20th untaught constant of the universe. Anywhere, I guarantee you, home, oh, look at this new coffee table we got. Within hours, it's going to be full of flat surface crap. And you guys can take this. I won't charge you for it. But it has made a difference. When we really focus on removing flat surface crap, you create a safer work environment. Last summer, I was down in Blanca, Texas at Real Ale Brewing. And we were taking a walk through the brewery. We noticed how clean everything was. Other than I noticed that, because brewers are brewers, there was they had the lockers there with the slope tops that go up so people don't put anything. Everybody's got their nice grippy brewer's boots. They're like, oh yeah, look at this. But they're very clean. So I don't know if anyone knows Lee Mayberry, who's the quality manager there. Well, I was talking to her about that, and she's talked about how important housekeeping was, and it improved their safety, but it was a struggle to get everybody to go. And I said, you know, I have a term for that. And I said, flat, and she goes, horizontal surface syndrome. I'm like, flat surface crap. We're like, what? And these little hearts, beep, beep, beep. We're like, what? She's married, I'm married. So, but I say that because there's other influences, aren't there, out there. It's not the people necessarily. It's not just the guards on the grinder or your SDS for welding gases. It's keeping a clean workplace. Just being super vigilant about that will actually have a very positive effect on your safety program.
Thank you, Jeff. So I'm going to synthesize an answer to the first question, which is the recalcitrant employees get housekeeping detail for punishment. Is there any form of, oh, okay, there we go. I think we've done that one. What are the best practices for clients, customers, or investors touring the production floor? Signed waivers, PPE, or something else? Abby.
If you require certain PPE on the manufacturing floor, people that are touring around should wear it too, unless they don't want to or can't. Then they get the dignitary tour, like I used to tour around the VP in the golf cart. Then they have to have like the unfun tour. So do you want to see stuff or do you want to like walk around stuff? And so if you want to see stuff, you need to be in the right gear.
Thanks, Abby. Great. Matt Courtwright was the best of us at Stone. I appreciate you bringing him up. Thank you. And, you know, we've got to keep these stories alive. They're how we learn and how we remember people. How do you, where do you start in building your own safety program? Try to give us a short answer, Rachel. That's a tough one.
I know. Honestly, like, most of what I had to do was self-taught. I was on my laptop at the bar all day just reading OSHA, using the BA resources. It's going to be a lot of that. Like, you have to educate yourself about what's out there. Fortunately, there are a lot of resources that synthesize that. But, yeah, like, you have to put some work in and then, you know, make a spreadsheet, use someone else's spreadsheet, figure out what you need written programs for. You know, it's going to be a lot of research early on. It's gonna be a lot of work.
Thanks, Jimmy.
The Brewers Association, like you mentioned, the resources, the Brewers Association has a complete video training program for on safety. We do that with every new employee day one. First day, before they get to touch any beer or get on the floor, they are sitting watching those videos, and they're repetitive, which means that they're boring, but it also means that it really hammers it in. So, even if you are like literally just getting started and have no clue, go through those videos, have your brewers go through those videos, have anybody who goes into the brewery go through those videos, and I bet you're also going to find when you watch them, like, oh, we need to do that, oh, we need to do that, and that might even get the ball rolling for you to find other things that you need to go and take care of, and it's going to go from there. So, but those Brewers Association training videos are fantastic.
Great, Jimmy. Thanks. We've got a committee you should join. Let's see. Can you give us some examples of measurables within a startup safety program? How can we track? I'll answer that one real quickly because just yesterday, Matt Gasiewicz, the sustainability ambassador, and I gave a talk on key performance indicators, what they are and how they apply to safety and sustainability. So get that after the conference. Get the slides on that. For an example, you're mostly looking for leading indicators, and in safety, a lot of these are just qualitative. They're not, you know, measurements coming from a device or something. They're like, we set a goal of setting up a safety committee with all departments represented in the next 3 months, and then we're going to meet 4 times in the next year. And then you look back at that in a year and you say, how'd we do? Okay, we met 3 times, we need to do better. We met 5 times, let's make it 8 next year. That sort of thing. That's how you use those indicators.
I found, along with tracking the number of accidents you have, which you legally have to do, also track near misses. These are where, just by the grace of God, somebody, you know, they stepped over 2 feet, and then the hammer fell and hit the ground right where they were. So tracking those can be helpful, because also they can help you find where incidents are going to happen in the future. You know, so near misses are a great thing to track as well. Like, this almost hurt me, but it didn't because of, you know, some bizarre reason or what have you. So near misses could be a great thing to track when you're just getting started as well.
Thanks, Jimmy. They are, and they're considered more forward-looking than looking at injuries that already occurred. How would you improve ladder safety? Lifts aren't possible in my brewery. Brewers Association has a resource that we're just about to publish on ladder usage. MBAA already has a guidance on ladders, and OSHA, and I think it's called the Ladder Institute. Yes, the Ladder Institute has guidance. So that's out there. And also, it sounds like stupidly obvious, but read the warning labels that are on the rails of a ladder. There's a lot of fine print on there that none of us ever pay any attention to. It will describe proper use.
But even outside of that, if the person asking this is in a position of leadership or responsibility, you know, take the time out of your day repeatedly to begin with to set the culture. When someone's about to use the ladder, just talk to them. I mean, communicate. Just remind them what you're supposed to be doing over and over again.
I think ladders. to bring up one of my pet peeves, where like the real cause of accidents is people rushing. That's what really causes accidents. People are running around trying to get a whole bunch of stuff done, and that's what actually happens. And ladders are a perfect example. You set it up half-assed. It's leaning over to the side. It might even maybe have, like, you know, at an angle or not at the right angle, and you're rushing up it, carrying too many bags of hops at the same time. You're not making 3 points of contact. You're in a rush. And so, like, a lot of accidents with ladders, that's the real cause, is in a rush. And this is where I've, now that I'm in a much smaller place, and we don't have huge packaging lines, we don't have like a lot of, you know, equipment that we need to lock out, tag out, and our concern, we don't have a welding department. Now our concerns and what we have to be compliant with is much, much smaller, but the number of, you know, we still have accidents. And my main focus is changing the culture to not rushing around, because that's where accidents happen. Safety is a bigger priority than quality, which is second, which is a bigger priority than the schedule, which is third, if that. So safety is number one, then quality is number two, and then the schedule is number three. And those top two, quality and safety, trump schedule every time. And we all know what it's like working in a brewery. You got a million things going on. You're rushing around. Right now there's a seminar going on about burnout. And we all know what that's like. We've all had people leave the our breweries because they were burned out. So for me, the main focus is kind of indirectly about safety, talking about slowing down. Take things slow and steady. You can't multitask. It's actually impossible. You can only think about one thing at a time. So, like, this is a, oh, I'm really good at multitasking. No, you're not. You're good at jumping back and forth between things, but you're not good at multitasking. You can only think about one thing at a time. So if it's where, oh man, we got to do this and we got to do that, and you can see the stress level starting to rise up, people go, fine, let's move that dry hop to tomorrow. It's fine. It's not the end of the world. It's just, we're just making beer. So stopping that culture of rush, 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 get it done, 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 now, go, 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 that will make your brewery a lot safer. And that's the number one thing I can think about, ladders too. And this is, again, this is something that you have to bring all the way up to the top, because if you have your owners or your managers coming down and yelling about how they need to get this done, you need to speed up the packaging line and stuff, then people are going to take that to heart and they're going to start running around like chickens with their heads cut off because the main man is saying that we got to do this. So, sorry, I know I'm rambling on, but yeah, slow and steady is fast and safe. If you do it slow and steady, your beer's going to be better too. You're going to make better beer because you're going to make fewer mistakes and cut fewer corners. There's so many amazing things that happen when you get your team to slow down and just concentrate on one thing at a time and not worry about the schedule. It doesn't rule your life. Anyway, yeah.
Thanks, Jimmy. How do you feel? Okay, good.
Yeah, I know.
Are there services for mock OSHA visits? Yes. So this is what we call OSHA consultation. That's the correct phrase. It's searchable. Every one of the 50 states has OSHA consultation office. They do not talk shop with the OSHA guys with the ticket book. That's by law. So they're oftentimes an entirely separate thing. For example, in some states, they might be based out of a university. You might have federal OSHA does OSHA citations, but a state OSHA agency or state labor board does consultations. They're quite often physically separated, too. So that's out there.
Hey, Matt, just one other resource. We talk about OSHA consultation a lot, and I know that people sometimes still get weird about OSHA. So don't forget about your insurance carrier and broker partners. They have risk control professionals like me on staff that we would much rather work with a client that's like, hey, can we talk about this, this, and that, instead of reactively working with clients after they have horrible claims. So, and that's free. You're already paying workers' comp premium, so get everything you can out of those companies.
If you went and did that with your insurance provider, might it bring your premiums down?
Yeah, like it makes you look really good when it's renewal time that you're working on things, if you're actively working on things. And they have tons of resources, so it's not just your carrier. I mean, if you're squirrely about talking to your workers' comp carrier because you're worried about exposing like all your dirty laundry, then talk to your broker. That's what I represent. We're there to be like that buffer between the insurance carriers and you as the paying customer for us. So we have resources too.
Fantastic. Thank you for bringing that up, Abby. We're going to try to do these last two quickly, and then we've archived the others. We'll answer later online for you. Is there an affordable but effective eyewash station you can recommend? We have the small manual squeeze station, but I'd like to upgrade. I'd like to take that one real quickly. One, we can't recommend anything as a trade association by manufacturer. Two, those squeeze bottles are a good first line of first aid. They obviously don't have very much volume in them, but one thing that people who have an eye injury don't think about is they're blinded to get to the eye wash. So sometimes something is at arm's length. OSHA uses the expression in the immediate area. So you know, and then but having an eye wash available is very important. Jim, you're going to tell your story real quick, aren't
no,
you?
No, without trying to name any specific providers, because we can't do that, there definitely are some. They're basically, the only problem is that they're a little bit bulky. They're about this big, and what it is it's all gravity-fed. You flip down the bottom, and it starts to run up. If you go to any, like, industrial supplier online and just search eyewash stations, you'll see them come up. Yeah, and I'm sure you guys know the good industrial supply companies that I can't name, apparently. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
So, and if you want a good eyewash story, talk to Jimmy afterwards. He's got one for you. Finally, can you talk about how to build a safety program in a small, predominantly tap room-focused brewery? And to answer that, I just want to go back here to this slide, and then we're going to call it a day. These are the five things that you need. And competence is the part where the safety stuff is in. That's where your OSHA requirements are. Small business guide is good, but management priorities, and put that in your company manual, in your employee orientation, in a shift meeting. A lot of really successful safety programs begin with making safety common conversation. Like, talk about safety when it isn't a problem, not in reaction to everything else. So, hey, guys, you know, we notice we've got this really big, in the case of a pub, we've got this really big group happening this weekend. These are some of the safety things we're thinking about that have a higher chance of happening. We've got to do more bathroom runs and make sure that there's no slippery surfaces in the bathrooms. Let's check the doormats. You know, if you live in an icy climate, think about the weather, those sort of things. And that's communication. Accountability could be a checklist. You know, we want to see 4 bathroom checks this shift. It's clipboard hanging on the door. Make sure all the staff know that they need to be participating. Everybody here will agree with me on this, that focusing on OSHA compliance is not your job. That's not going to get the job done. Focusing on worker well-being is where your head needs to be at. And in doing that, you will comply with a lot of OSHA. And OSHA's requirements, as hard as they may seem to you, are only the minimum requirement by law. So, and your chance of being inspected is low. So if you're using that as your measurement, you're kind of like going off in the wrong direction. Make your workplace safe and healthful for everybody. It improves morale. It reduces injuries. And you retain employees longer. So with that, we'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank our guest speakers today. Thanks very much, and we'll be around if you want to chat one-on-one.